Oh man, are you ready for this?
Ready for this?
This is a Dreamcast disc and is for use only on a Dreamcast unit. Playing this disc on a hi-fi or other audio equipment can cause serious damage to its speakers.
Dreamcast, up to 6 billion players.
A beautiful example in the arts of the combination attack.
Dash.
In your head. This is gonna be a match to remember.
Hello and welcome to episode 76 of the Dreamcast Junkyard Dream Pod. It's not just the Dream Pod though, it's also a Saturn Junkyard Titan Cast because we are doing what's known in the industry as a mashup. Yes, I said mashup. My name is Tom. I'm joined by my regular colleagues from the Dreamcast Junkyard Dream Pod. I've got Mike. Hello, Mike.
Hey, Tom.
I've got Lewis. Hi, Lewis.
Yo.
And I've got Martin. Hello, Martin.
How you doing, Tom? Hello, everyone.
And from the Sega Saturn Junkyard Titan Cast, we have Brian. Hi, Brian.
Greetings. Thanks for having us, Tom.
No problem at all. We have Nuno.
What's up, guys?
What's up? And we have Simon. Hello, Simon.
Hello, guys. You all right?
This is the first time we've actually all been together on a podcast, which is a little bit strange, but also very... very cool, because we've been talking about doing something like this for a long, long time, and now we're finally all together in the same virtual room to talk all things Sega. Well, Sega's last two systems anyway, the Dreamcast and the Saturn, as the names of our respective podcasts and sites suggest. We are Dreamcast and Saturn. I was going to say aficionados, but I wouldn't really call myself an aficionado of anything, let alone a Dreamcast or a Saturn.
Yeah, maybe enthusiasts or
yeah. Yes, enthusiasts. Yeah. The format that this podcast is going to take is that basically all the guys from the Dream Pod have chosen three of their favorite Saturn games, and all the guys from the Titan Cast have chosen three of their favorite Dreamcast games. And we're just going to go in a kind of round robin and discuss our chosen games for a couple of minutes each, and just explain why we've chosen them, really, because I think there's a lot of love in this virtual room for both systems. And it just gives us a chance to talk a little bit about something other than our chosen console. I, for one, occasionally do get a little bit tired of talking about all the great games in the Dreamcast, and this will allow me to speak about some of my favorite Saturn games. So without further ado, gentlemen, if you're ready, we shall begin. And the first person to make a choice or tell us about his choice of game number one is Mike. Mike, the floor is yours. Tell us, enlighten us.
Excellent. So the first choice I have made is Mass Destruction, which is a fantastic top-down sort of blast-em-up, I suppose you could say. Just a really good game. It's a game which is not really that common on any console, especially not Dreamcast. So get back to Saturn and having this sort of... it's almost like a little sandbox-type affair where you have a little tank and you just blow up everything. Very similar, to Expendable and Dreamcast. Sort of quite a basic game, but really fun and really enjoyable. And a game which I think doesn't get enough attention in anyone, really. I think it's not mentioned much at all, and I think it deserves to be.
Thanks, Mike, for your first choice. I was hoping to have a break from talking then, but I'm next on the list, so I'm going to go with my next, my first game even, and that is Daytona USA Championship Circuit Edition. Now, the reason I've chosen this one is because I was a big fan of the original game, but let's be honest, the Saturn game is a bit of a dog's dinner. It's got a draw distance of about 8 feet, and just doesn't look very good, and is just a poor man's Sega Rally, in my opinion. Obviously not the same kind of game, but Daytona Championship Circuit Edition was a later game, came out a couple of years later, and it was basically the game that the first game should have been. It did have a slightly weird soundtrack, a slightly weird rock soundtrack, in place of the kind of camp Japanese rocky Daytona USA soundtrack. But I think it kind of fixed a lot of the problems. It did have a slightly different handling model as well. And out of all of the Daytona games released on consoles, Daytona USA, Daytona CCE, and then Daytona 2001 on the Dreamcast, I think this one is actually my favourite, because it gets the mix of arcade kind of handling, but also a little bit of realism in there as well. So yeah, Daytona CCE is my choice. Lewis, you have the floor.
Okay, so my first pick is KO Flying Squadron 2.
Which is actually a game I discussed for the Saturn Junkyard's top 100 game list, despite the fact it didn't even make the top 100 list. But Brian was nice enough to let me have a slot on the list anyway to ramble about this game. And it's, you know, it's a fairly bog-standard anime-centric platformer. And it's only got a few shoot 'em up segments, which is what the first KO Flying Squadron game was famous for. And it's probably one of those games that kind of was put on the move on and forget pile for a lot of people. And also, it wasn't released in North America, so that didn't help at all as well. So, but we got it here in Europe. I don't have a copy, but I burnt it and played it on Pseudo Saturn. And I just thought it was a real like fun time. I think it's one of those games that's more about the overall experience than doing anything revolutionary in the gameplay department. And I said it best in my write-up, really, that what it lacks in original gameplay, it makes up for imagination. I love the kind of random levels with the underground mines and the theme park and the ninja castle. And then you've got the storyline and the voice acting, which is campy and ridiculous. The bosses are weird, and I love all the references to Japanese culture, modern and ancient. So, yeah, it's a good laugh and a really underrated game on the Saturn, I think. And I recommend playing it because I think it'll surprise you like it did me.
Yeah, it's an interesting one, that. I did play the demo. That's the only version I played on the Saturn. I did play the original on the Mega CD. And the one thing that sticks in my mind about that game is that one of the enemies is, I think it's a... it's a raccoon or something in a floating rowing boat that just keeps coming across the screen. And I just, that just always stuck with me as being a bit odd. But yeah, nice choice, Lewis. Okay, let's move on. Martin, what's your first choice for the Saturn?
Hey, so my first choice for the Saturn is Christmas Nights. And I'm not sure this is my favorite Saturn game. That's actually really hard. I've got like a top five that I just keep flipping through, kind of the same with pretty much anything. Never really can settle on a winner, but Christmas Nights is my number one pick. So this came on the front cover of Sega Saturn magazine in Christmas 96. And I'd just got the Saturn for my birthday in September, so I didn't have many games at all. What I particularly like about this game is that I actually think it's better than the standard Knights. I do like Knights a lot, but the Christmas Knights is just fantastic. You've got all of the unlockables in there. It's arguably got a better version of kind of a truer version of the game, which is this link attack, where you can essentially try and just build as big a link as you possibly can. Which is something that you try and do in the standard game, but with this separate mode here, I think it just sets itself apart. You've also got all the other unlockables, and so it's got that kind of, yeah, repeat play kind of mechanic and addiction that you get with it. There's the museum, karaoke, a couple of videos. There's also the trailers of the standard Knights and all of the little changes that come about when you use the internal clock on the Sega Saturn, which was absolutely fantastic. So, of course, when you got it at Christmas, you play the game and then it turns into New Year and then it's this whole new game. Then playing it throughout the year, of course, it was later leaked, but back through magazines, not the internet, that if you change the clock to April Fool's, you could play as Riala. And it's just, yeah, a really unique game in that sense. Also, aside from the, I think, brilliant music, but I imagine if someone else was in the house when you're playing it, it would drive them crazy if you're playing that for hours with this jingle bells, constant, incessant music. But I think it's brilliant. And also, we can't forget that it technically includes Sonic's first proper 3D outing. So I was incredibly excited to have a 3D Sonic unlocked and playable here. I thought, this is it. Here comes the next Sonic game on the Saturn. Boy, was I in for a real disappointment there. But trying to end on a high note, Christmas Nights is one of the best games I've ever played. You can get it for almost no money now, and there's just no excuse not to play this.
Excellent, excellent stuff. Before we continue, I just want to ask the guys from the Titan Cast, have you got any comments or any revulsions to any of the games that we've picked so far?
Well, no, not really. I mean, I think they're all very solid titles that you can't really go wrong with. Christmas Nights, and you mentioned the Sonic levels, right? Which is very interesting to me how rudimentary that was, where they kind of jury-rigged the Knight's play space to accommodate, you know, Sonic running around, and it was uncharacteristically slow. And the mechanics weren't quite really built for that. And so it was just really interesting, that Sonic Team went out of their way for a game that they weren't even charging money for, right? Because this was released as a demo, for free, you know, after the fact. To have that nifty little touch of just including Sonic in there, even when they didn't really need to, I think is one of the things that makes that game, among many other things, a very endearing thing to revisit every year. And yeah, I definitely love it.
Excellent stuff. Okay, then let's move on to our second pick. Mike, away you take it.
So my second pick. So I've recently got a Saturn back again, quite about 3 months ago. I hadn't had Saturn for quite a while, and one of the reasons I bought it was to get the shoot 'em ups. I've got quite a fair few of them now. But one game I wanted, which wasn't a shoot 'em up, so I had a list of 100 games I want, and of all the games I've got, there's some quite expensive ones, there's some really quite out there ones. There's one game which no one ever talks about, and I wanted to pick it. It's Street Racer. I think in Japan it's called Street Racer Extra. I'm not entirely sure, but the PAL version is what I played. I loved the game on the Mega Drive. So the game, it was a 16-bit racing game on the Mega Drive and SNES. It was a pretty standard one. It was a 3D one, or as 3D as Mega Drive could go. But on the Saturn, I first played on Saturn, and actually I was blown away by how different it was. It's a proper sort of karting game, but the environments are really alive. They feel like they're quite compact. But everything feels like it's just a fun, comedic kart racing game, which I think the Saturn didn't have a huge amount of, and not many consoles at all had them at the time, apart from Mario Kart. So I was really surprised by how good it was compared to what I thought it was going to be like. And I played it probably more than any other game on Saturn at all when I first had a Saturn several years ago. It reminds me very much of a game on the PC called Big Red Racing. Very different sort of format, but that sort of slightly anarchic, chaotic fun of the late 1990s. And it's a really good game. It's got, you know, good soundtrack. It's got graphics nice and bright and colourful. Characters are very alive. It feels a little bit like Power Drift as well for a later generation. It's quite cheap, I think. On the PAL still, haven't bought many PAL games recently, but it's a really good underrated game which doesn't get much attention at all, and I think definitely one of my picks. I could have picked one of the many shoot 'em ups instead of this. I was debating whether to do something a bit more gamer like, but actually Street Racer is just a damn fun game, which I think is more important sometimes.
Yeah. Interesting choice as well. Street Racer for the Saturn, back in the mist of time when I could still be bothered making YouTube videos before the horrendous comments just got the better of me. I did a video on the comparison between certain Saturn games and PlayStation games, and Street Racer is one that you'd think would be the same game, but it really isn't. The Saturn version is so much more advanced than the PlayStation version, and it's actually really sort of quite surprising how different and how much better the Saturn version is. Not just the quality of the graphics, it's actually the 3D models and everything in the levels. It's a fantastic game. Yeah. Okay, I shall move on to myself next. Tom, what would you like to talk about next? Oh, okay, Tom, I will talk about... Slightly surreal moment.
Tom's going insane, finally.
I am going to talk next about a game that I like for the Saturn, which is called Quake. You may have heard of it. I'm a huge fan of the Doom games and the id shooters that preceded Quake. I wasn't a fan of the Saturn version of Doom because it ran at like 3 frames a second. But when Quake came on the Saturn, I'd seen in the run-up to the Saturn version, all the magazine articles I'd read about Quake in magazines on the PC. And it was just like, oh, yes, I love the kind of biomechanical, eldritch, medieval kind of themed horror that Quake had in the world. And that was one of the main things that drew me to Doom's world, the kind of biomechanical, almost kind of Lovecraftian, H.R. Giger-ish kind of horror that was contained in that universe. And so Quake was right up my street. And the Saturn version is actually the first version I ever played. And obviously, compared to the PC original on a decent spec'd PC, it looks a bit ropey. But it was the game that kind of was my gateway into all of those first-person shooters on the Saturn, like Exhumed, Duke Nukem 3D that followed. And yeah, it was kind of my introduction into that world of Quake. And obviously after that, Quake 2 and Quake 3 Arena and Quake 4 and all the rest of it. But yeah, I squarely put my love of this game, of this game series, with the Saturn version. Also, as well, it's compatible with the 3D controller, so that helps with the controls and the slightly dodgy frame rate. It's quite easy to line up your shots with the 3D pad. And it's just the fact that it's a real technical marvel on the Saturn. You've got these huge 3D environments, these massive open spaces, these polygonal monsters that are jumping out, and on top of that, you've got real-time light sourcing. And this game is a game that people said couldn't be done on the Saturn, and yet there it is running. And, you know, it's not 60 frames a second. It's barely 30 frames a second. I think it's about 20 frames a second, but it's playable and it's Quake. And unlike the N64 version, which I later played after playing Quake on the Saturn, the Saturn version does have all of the levels in all of their complete form from the PC original, whereas the N64 version has massively reduced levels, hardly any of the effects that are seen in the Saturn version. So for a console, you know, that's punching above its weight, Quake on the Saturn really is a special game for me. That's my choice for my second pick.
Can I just add something there, rather beautiful to that little review there, Tom, as well? One of the lovely things about both of our communities is how much stuff is shared between us. And I now actually own that copy of Quake that you've just waxed so beautifully about, because you sent that to me. I don't know if you remember, but you sent that to me as a gift.
I do remember that. Yeah, very, very vaguely, yes.
So it has a beautiful memory for me for another reason as well. And I'm tearing up right now.
Brilliant. Yeah. God, yeah, I forgot about that. Anyway, enough from me and enough from Quake and enough of Simon's tears. Okay, Lewis, onwards. What's your second pick, please?
Okay, so my second pick is Nights into Dreams. And I think Nights is a fantastic game, and I think it just deserved a better fate than what it got, really. I mean, I know it's highly regarded, but I don't think recognition of its excellence ever really crossed over to the mass audience of gamers. And it's a shame, because I think this game is it does everything it sets out to be. It's got a cool main character. The gameplay is unique. It's fun to pick up, and it's a lot of fun to master as well. And it's a 3D game on a not really 3D system, and it still looks really good. I mean, it may not look as clean as something like Crash Bandicoot, but I still think that the vivid colors on display really set it apart from its counterparts of the era. And I think that the graphics, along with its really amazing musical score, transport you to that kind of childlike wonder and innocent imagination that it's trying to convey throughout in this dream world that the game takes place in. And I think it's quite deep as well. I think, Martin's already told us about all the things that were in Christmas Nights into Dreams, and it has a lot of depth to it in that regard. There's a lot of like extra layers, you know, on the surface, it looks like it's just another arcadey point scoring kind of game, you know, racking up scores to get to the next level. But, you know, you've also got stuff like the Nightopians, which were like the blueprint for the Chows in Sonic Adventure. And you can like merge them with enemies to make evil Nightopians. And then there's this like weird mechanic where if you endanger them, the music in the levels change and it sounds less rich and vibrant, almost like as a punishment to say like stop endangering like the wildlife or something. So it's an example of just another one of those games that Sega are remembered for, just unique and just amazing. So yeah, if you've not played it, you need to. And if you have a Saturn and you don't own this, then you're missing out.
Yeah, it's a great game. I can vividly remember playing it on the TV at home. And I was playing the boss battle, you know, with a big bouncing ball going through the walls.
Mm.
And my brother and a couple of my mates came in. And they were all just standing there in silence, kind of watching me play this game. And they all had PlayStations. And when I kept losing, I kept dying for some reason. I couldn't do it. And one of them was like, give me that control. I want to play this. And then they just kept passing it. And then the next day at school, I walked into one of the classrooms and one of the guys was talking about it, and he was like, yo, Tom, what was that game you was playing last night? And I was like, oh, Knights. He went, yeah, Knights. And he was going on talking to all these, like, this big crowd of people about Knights. Like, I was like, this is surreal. But yeah, it was.
that is awesome. But because the art style of Knights is incredibly Japanese, and it just doesn't kind of fit in with the way that gaming was kind of going at that time. I don't really think it was all starting to get into, not really serious, but like as you said earlier, there's Quake, there's football games, there's all this kind of stuff, and then Knights is just, what is this? But at the same time, that's its complete charm, exactly as Lewis was saying. So I kind of picked Christmas Knights. I do think, yeah, ultimately it's the better game for me, but Knights, absolutely love that. I remember getting this game. I got it for my birthday the following September, so I'd had Christmas Knights all that time, and then had all these levels to play in the full Knights, and it's almost the perfect game. Exactly as Lewis said, it set out to do what it was going to do. It did it, and there's almost nothing really inherently wrong with it. Some of the top-down parts of the game can get a bit clunky with controls, but I mean, with the 3D controller, it's just absolutely superb. I don't know if you've played any of the Xbox ports or anything like this on PSN and XBLA, but they're just not quite as tight as the old original.
I played that Wii version, which I wasn't a big fan of, but the less said about that, the better.
I played it and I refuse to acknowledge its existence.
The worst part about that was that they gave Knights a voice, which just took it all of the sort of the mystical qualities of that character away, if you ask me.
Yes, yeah, completely.
I just also wanted to add, and I think one of the challenges that Knights faced at the time is that, because it was released late in 96, right? And it was firmly in the shadow of Crash Bandicoot, especially of Super Mario 64. And so as Sega's competitors were really pushing these as their platform-defining mascots, I think Knights had the unenviable challenge of having to kind of take the mantle that maybe a Sonic game would have. And a lot of people associated Sonic Team, of course, since they developed it, as, you know, having this new spiritual successor. And so they pushed it. I think a lot of people perceived, and Sega maybe miscommunicated what Knights was. And a lot of people thought it might be a platformer in the vein of the big games it was competing against. And I think that did it really no favors. And in fact, it really was, you know, in the frame of like a Score Attack game. I almost think it has more in common with like a Tony Hawk's Pro Skater than any Sonic the Hedgehog game. So I'm glad that the community has kind of rallied around it in the intervening years to really support this game and give it the love it deserves.
Tony Hawk's Into Dreams.
I do see what you mean though, Brian, with the sort of like combo system and yeah, it's a good comparison.
Yeah
it is a spot on, actually, because if you're playing Knights as a platformer, you're playing it wrong.
Indeed, just like if you're playing Tony Hawk's as a flying acrobatics game, you're playing that wrong as well. Okay, Martin, let's move on to your second choice.
Yeah, so my second choice is Wipeout 2097.
Love a bit of Wipeout.
Wipeout series for me is one of the best game series that has ever existed. I think it's a crying shame what's ended up happening to the franchise, but that's a whole other rant that I'll have to take down to a pub when I'm next allowed in one. but the 2097, with the first game, I played that when I was about 12 years old or so on a friend's PlayStation, or relative's PlayStation. And yeah, the collision mechanics for that meant that if you touch the wall at all, your ship would stop. And when you're 12 years old, that's incredibly frustrating and unforgiving. The 2097, they brought in the kind of grinding mechanic a little bit. So you would kind of grind against the side and it would give you just a fighting chance to pull away. So I think the controls of the game are very, very good. It isn't as good a port or as good a game as the PlayStation game in terms of the overall handling, frame rate, and graphics. But apart from that, it's brilliant. And part of the reason that I like the game, actually, is the very consistent soundtrack across the whole game. Because in the PlayStation version, I didn't even know at the time, but there was all this licensed music from the Chemical Brothers, Prodigy, all this kind of stuff. Music that I absolutely love, incidentally. But this the cold storage music for the game is very good and tight and consistent throughout the whole game. It's a very difficult racing game. The whole series is. This one's no exception. But it's very rewarding. So when you pull off these fast lap times, I mean, it really, to me, challenges Sega Rally in terms of going to a course and just spending an hour doing laps around a course to try and just get that time better and better and better. Also uses the analog controller as well, which, yeah, not everyone knew about, but is a really nice way to play the game. And yeah, it's a better game than the original Wipeout. Not as good a port, as I said earlier, as the PlayStation, but if you've got a Saturn and you like your racing games, then this is going to be a challenging game.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of the Wipeout series, a big fan of Wipeout 2097 on whichever console I own it on. I have to make a little bit of an admission here that my favorite Wipeout ever is probably Wipeout 64, just for that silky smooth analog control. I don't know, the others just don't feel as good to me, but I'm open to being told that I'm wrong. But yeah, good choice. Do any of the other guys from the Titan cast have any other comments on our picks for that round?
Yeah, I'd just like to say how completely in agreement I am about the music in Wipeout 2097 on the Saturn. I do think it's actually superior to the licensed tracks. There's a guy called Tim Wright did the music for it under the name of Cold Storage. And his tunes, like, I sometimes put Wipeout 2097 in my van CD player and just listen to the music because it's so good. So I'd just like to sort of endorse what was said before.
Okay, cool. Good picks. We're getting on to our final games now, our final round of Saturn games from the Dreamcast Junkyard crew. I'm going to go back to the top of the list, and Mike, I'm going to come to you for your final game.
So my final choice is my favourite game on Saturn, bar none. My favourite game on any console, previous Dreamcast, actually, I think, which is Winter Heat. I love the Winter Olympics as a whole spectacle anyway. And I love sort of arcade sports games. And Winter Heat for me is just the perfect game. There's 11 events. It's a sequel to Decathlete or Athlete Kings, which was sort of an earlier Saturn game based on Summer Olympics, obviously based on the decathlon itself. But Winter Heat sort of takes everything and just ups it. So there's 11 events. It's not all button mashing. There's 3D skiing, 3D snowboarding. There are some which, you know, resort back to the old press the button as fast as you can, but even they're done quite well. And just the entire game is just, it looks fantastic, it plays fantastic, it's really smooth, the graphics are really good. There's lots of character. They did, of course, try and do a sequel to this on a Dreamcast, which we're not going to talk about, which is based in Summer again. But the Winter one, I just think, was a perfect game. Obviously, it's an arcade port as well. It's a really good port of what they had in the arcades. And it's just, everything about it is just, it captures the spectacle of what a Winter Olympics type event is quite well, or as well as you can for a console game at this time. And just every single event, there's 11, like I said, 11 events, there's... Each one of them is done really well, and there's loads of replay value in this game, which I think you can't really say the same about many sports games at this time. They've aged quite badly. Winter Heat's a game you can still put on now and still enjoy just as much. And yeah, I think it's my favorite Saturn game. Really cheap as well, Japanese version or the PAL version if you're in the UK, and the American version I presume as well. So it's a perfect game for me, and I think with all the games I've got, you know, I've played some amazing games on Saturn, but actually I think Winter Heat is the only one which I would still be playing in 10, 15 years' time every couple of weeks, because it's that good.
Wow, that is high praise indeed. I have to be honest, Mike, for reasons that I'm sure other people will kind of echo. I'd never played this game, and the reason why is that I played Athlete Kings, and Athlete Kings seemed to me like just like a stereotypical button masher of an athletics game, and I just don't find them fun. I gave this one a miss. I played, is it Virtual Athlete, which is the sequel?
Cast one, yeah.
I didn't like that either. So for naturally, I would assume that Winter Heat was the kind of the same. But if you're saying that it's not, and you're giving it such high praise, then maybe this is one that I need to revisit.
I mean, it's not a million miles away. I'm not talking about sort of a game which is completely departing from the format. There is still the same sort of track and field elements, as it were. But it takes everything up to a higher level. I've always been a fan of winter sports games anyway, back on the 8-bits with winter games and things like that. They always did something a bit different, they always delivered it a bit differently because of the events aren't just, running fast or jumping high, because there's more of a spectacle about them. They have to do something different, and I think Winter Heat, they do it really, really well. I mean, are any of the events on their own good enough to stand up, as a game? Of course, they're probably not. There are still ultimately mini games, but as a package, and as an arcade-type experience, and a multiplayer experience, I will die on the hill of saying that I think it's up there with the very best on the Saturn.
I agree with Mike completely with what he said there, and I would just add, as a multiplayer, it's a fantastic game. I used to play it all the time with my brother, and it was so competitive, and just a really fun game. By yourself, I can imagine it just being a bit of a semi-boring button masher at times, but there's enough scope in there, and back in the day for me, the memories of it were as a multiplayer and some really competitive games there. So yeah, it's a great pick.
Yeah, I mean, Tom, I honestly, if you didn't like Athlete Kings, or Decathlete as we call it in North America, which is a vastly inferior title, I think Athlete Kings is way better. Winter Heat isn't really going to change your mind. I think the structure is fundamentally the same, and the things that turn people off of that kind of game, which is really how limited it is, and that it really gives the player almost no agency for strategizing or exploration or other things that sports games can do a really good job with. It's very straightforward and very simplistic. But I will also say my favorite thing about that game is failing. Just the sheer animations and the detail they have when you botch a aerial jump and you just fall flat on your face. It's gruesome. I mean, maybe not gruesome because it's, there's no graphic blood or anything, but it's hilarious nonetheless. And one of my favorite things in that game is just going through it and seeing all the different ways that you can completely crash and burn. And in fact, Simon, that reminds me, we had made a video for the Saturn Junkyard YouTube channel a couple of years ago during the last Winter Olympics that kind of highlighted some of that. So just wanted to throw that out there.
Don't talk about that, Brian. The less said about that, the better.
Now I need to go and find this video.
it's amateur green screen at its finest.
Oh, excellent. Even more so, I need to find it now. okay, I shall move on. And my third and final game, and possibly my favourite game on the Saturn. No, it is my favourite game on the Saturn. I know it's a bit of a cop-out, guys. I apologise profusely, but it's the one and only Sega Rally. Sega Rally Championship has to be my favourite Saturn game. It's the game that came with my Saturn on that Christmas morning back in 1995, 6, one of the two, I can't remember. But this game went into that CD drawer. All the other games that came with the Saturn didn't even get a look in. That game was played nonstop the whole of Christmas Day, and it continued to get played nonstop for the rest of the Christmas break. And was the one game that I never actually got rid of the whole time that I had my Sega Saturn. And it's still a game I play today. I mean, myself and Mike, this is a bit of a shameless plug, but we do another podcast that is a Rally Games podcast, and our first episode was on this game, Sega Rally, the legend that is. And we spoke for good 45 minutes about how cool this game is, from everything from the way it looks to the way it plays to the music to the, even though it's got a really small, quite minuscule really in reality, complement of tracks, the fact that it's only got two or three vehicles. It doesn't matter. It's just so infinitely replayable. And a little anecdote for you is there was a period where I hadn't picked up a Saturn pad for about, I'd say about 10 years. And I was at an expo and there was a Sega Saturn and it was playing demo. It was demo moding Sega Rally. So I picked up the control pad and I used to be a bit of a demon on Sega Rally. I'll say this even, you know, even if I say so myself. I picked up that control pad and it was like I'd never, ever put a pad down. I started the arcade mode. I basically completed it and got first place on Lakeside, I'll have you know. And it was like I'd never been away from the game. It's just that good. Once you've got it, you've got it. And, you know, what better advert for awesome playability and just memorable tracks and everything. Even the music, I could still remember how the music went, everything. It's just in my blood, this game. Is, you know, it's a game that made me. Sega Rally is just an awesome game. And, you know, I don't really know what else to say about it. If you've never played it, then sort your life out.
I don't think you can listen to this and not have played Sega Rally.
I would hope so, yeah, yeah.
I would be amazed. So just to echo what you're saying there, Tom, great pick. It is my favourite game on the Saturn. Always was, always will be. It is part of my almost DNA, exactly as you're saying here. So I think between us, we could actually draw the tracks right now if we had to.
Oh, I can. I'm doing them in my head now. No.
I'm playing it. I'm doing Desert Stage right now. So with also the soundtrack, as you say, that actually inspired me to learn the guitar. The soundtrack is absolutely amazing. The brilliant thing about Saturn games as well, like games of old, you could just put the put it in your CD player. And you could, then the Saturn was a CD player, by the way. It doubles as a brilliant multimedia system. So I used to play, just the music from that. And the whole game, the handling is just, it's unrivaled. Just amazing pick. Great choice.
Just to go back to the Rally podcast that me and Mike do, I did actually look for the guy who does the voiceover in the credits. I found his LinkedIn and sent him a message asking if he could do us a message, but he ignored me, and I'm not surprised.
Sure, that's your special talent, isn't it, Tom, looking for voice actors' profiles online?
I believe the technical term is stalking, but so we won't get into that. So, yeah, that's my pick, Sega Rally. Okay, Lewis, onwards for your final pick, please.
Okay, so I mentioned Pseudo Saturn when I spoke about KO Flying Squadron 2, and I love Pseudo Saturn because it's what enabled me to play this third choice, because this game has an absolutely ridiculous monetary value. I believe it was the last ever officially released game in America for the Saturn, and that's Magic Knight Rayearth. And I felt when I finally first discovered Pseudo Saturn, I had to burn this one almost out of defiance against the resellers who've put this on eBay for like £1,000, whatever it goes for, I think. I've not checked for a while. But yeah, I had that same rush burning this game as I was when I was 12 downloading Blink-182 songs from LimeWire. Anyway, so there's a lot of games that are expensive secondhand, but I think this one actually kind of lives up to its quality. Maybe not £1,000 worth of quality, but it's still really good. And I can really understand why people seek it out to play it. I think it captures all the charm of the really good anime and manga series that it's based on. I love the characters, the dialogue's great, that working design script as well as a highlight here. And the story is in general is excellent. And the top-down action RPG gameplay is decent and it's varied. And another thing is, if you ever wanted to show someone what the Saturn is capable of when it comes to producing 2D sprites, I think this is a really good showcase, because every nook and cranny of the world that is in this game looks really, really gorgeous. And it looks kind of like it's almost like it's lifted straight from like a watercolor painting. So there's a lot of good-looking RPGs and action RPGs on the Saturn, but I think what makes this one so special to me and why I've picked it is the depth to its plot and the characters and the way that it executes its plot. So, having three characters already to play with really adds a whole other layer of depth. And they have different personalities and views on things when they each interact with objects, and they have their own opinion or quip about what they're looking at. And to add to that, they even have like diaries in the start menu, and you can read their individual thoughts about what's going on. And so it's just like a really deep game as far as story. There's even like this one bit at the beginning with the first boss fight where each character has to go against the boss individually, and the boss takes the form of something that they love to try and weaken them and stop them from defeating it. So yeah, it's a really good game story wise and I think that's probably what made it so memorable to me. I really, it's just a really charming game, really character heavy game. And yeah, so if you can burn it like I did, definitely do that, because it deserves to be played. And it's just such a shame that a lot of people haven't had a chance to play this, because like I say, it's just ridiculously expensive, and they may not know about something like Pseudo Saturn, or they don't have a Saturn with a mod chip, for example. So yeah, play it. It's excellent.
Wow, very interesting stuff. I must admit that it's a game I'd heard the name of, but I didn't really know anything about it. So hearing you speak about it so highly, it makes me want to investigate further. So yeah, any of you guys on the Saturn played this game?
I sadly have not. it's certainly towards the top of my to-do list for sure. To date, Magic Knight Ray Earth eludes me.
It does sound very interesting. And as a slight side note, Brian and Simon, I have been looking at Google in the while I've not been speaking, and I found the video thumbnail for your Winter Olympics are heating up on the junkyard. So yeah, that shall be added to my watch later. And
sure. I mean, it's, you know, it's not a big priority. You could wait until the next Olympics, I guess. It'll be top.
I could save it. Yeah, I could save it for then. Yeah. Okay. Thank you, Lewis, for that rather interesting chat about Magical Knight Ray Earth. Martin, that brings us on to you. Last but not least, what is your final pick for the Saturn?
Yeah. So my final Saturn pick is Dodonpachi, which is pronounced beautifully in British English there, or Dodonpach, how the Japanese would say it enthusiastically. So I came to this quite late, kind of 2005 time, when I was getting into the import scene. And this was before I went down the whole path of learning Japanese and eventually moving to Japan and living there. This was one of the games that kind of fueled that. So it was this and another game called Grandia on the Dreamcast, but that's a separate topic. So Dodonpachi, it's import only, so yeah, you've got to get the Japanese version if you want to play it. And in all fairness, for those of you who are into shoot 'em ups, shmups, it's not the best port of the game, but it shouldn't stop people from playing it and giving it a go, because it is a really, really nice example of the genre. So this is, it's a shoot 'em up from Cave, so it's a top-down kind of scrolling shoot 'em up, vertical shooter, and it's in the bullet hell genre that Cave kind of made for themselves, pretty much, with the first game, Dodonpachi, and then this one, the sequel. So for me, yeah, it's just extremely addictive in the same way that, to be honest, all of the games that I've mentioned and talked about, and also quite a few of the others, have got this really heavy replay value. This game has it in spades. So it's the same as Sega Rally and this kind of time attack, any kind of link attack thing. With this, it's all about how far can you last on your one credit? What score can you get with that credit? And yeah, this was a slippery slope for me, and now I've got an Xbox 360 with the whole collection and all sorts of problems with arcade sticks and where do I keep them, which one's better, which arcade stick works best. So Dodonpachi started for me this whole kind of journey into a genre where I'd never really been before. I played in Space Invaders, of course, everyone has. And before that, and a few other of these kind of horizontal scrolling shooters, I never really liked them that much. There were a couple on the Mega Drive, and I just thought, yeah, not really for me. And then something about Dodonpachi really clicked. And yeah, I'm kind of throwing it in there as a latecomer for me personally. It wasn't one that I was playing back in the Saturn's heyday, but having come onto the import scene, it's got a place in the collection.
That's really interesting. Another one that I need to add to my list. I will make this admission now. I only have one Sega Saturn, but it's actually broken, and it's a Japanese one. So I have to play all my Saturn games on the Mac, which is fine. They work really well. But the beauty of that is that I can just download these games as ROMs. I don't know if I'm allowed to say that on a Titan cast, if that's sacrilege or not. But
oh, absolutely not. No, we only endorse piracy on the Titan cast.
Excellent.
If you did want to like dabble your toe in kind of shmup land, give me a shout, Tom, and I can steer you in kind of what I would say a smooth direction forward. I wouldn't say Dodonpachi on that. If you wanted to compare that to kind of how the arcade version runs, but you can just get it on MAME, basically. So you can download MAME and play it on there. And that is a much more faithful port of the arcade game. Not that it'll matter if it's your first go, because you're going to die within like 20 seconds. So
sounds like hell.
It's a challenge.
Brilliant. It's a challenge. Okay, guys, that brings us to the end of the Dreamcast Junkyard's selections. I'll just quickly run through those games that we all picked. So Mike chose Mass Destruction, Street Racer, and Winter Heat. I chose Daytona CCE, Quake, and Sega Rally. Lewis chose KO Flying Squadron 2, Nights into Dreams, and Magical Knight Ray Earth. And Martin chose Christmas Nights into Dreams, Wipeout 27, and Dodonpachi. I tried to make it sound as un-Japanese as possible there. Hopefully,
yeah, Dodonpachi. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. At this point, I am going to hand over to Brian, who's going to guide us through the picks of the Titancast crew for the Dreamcast. Brian, are you ready? I've got the baton here. I'm holding it. I'm reaching out across the ether. Have you got it?
I've got it now.
Okay, I'm letting go.
All right, let it go. Wait, oh shit. No, wait, okay. No. I got it. Thank you very much again for having us, of course. And yeah, this has been really fun so far. And at this point in the podcast, I feel I need to apologize in advance for the fact that things are going to get a lot less professional from here on out. And I also want to thank you all for recording on Discord. We had to kind of call an audible a little bit there. Mainly, I'm just happy that we're not on like a video style service, because I'm still sporting my quarantine neck beard right now. So pretty happy to just have the audio for this one. I think we can start. We'll do a similar round table discussion. A little bit different, though. There are three of us. So to equalize the number of games, you all picked 12 different games. So we'll be picking 12 different games, and that'll be 4 games per person because math. Let's just start this off. I think I'll go in the order that we appear in the chat here. So, Nuno, go for it. What's your first pick?
Well, my first pick is Jet Set Radio. It was my very first Dreamcast game, so personally it has a really big meaning to me. But other than that, I think that it's a game that, for me, really symbolizes what the Dreamcast was all about. It was about new games, original titles, not just sequels to established franchises or new games in established genres, you know? Because what is Jet Set Radio? I mean, what style of game is it? I mean, we could consider it some type of action game, because there's action involved. You run around on roller skates and you spray graffiti and you run away from the cops. And gameplay-wise, it was incredibly unique. And visually, it was too. It's the game that popularized cel shading. I don't know if it's technically the first game ever. And the actual visual style, besides the technical element, just the visual style was really unique. It was very futuristic, almost cyberpunk in a way. And through all of these, with all of this combined, the unique gameplay, the graphics that really stand the test of time, because they weren't trying to be realistic, they were trying to go for like an expressive look, a really highly stylized look. And because of all of that, I think it's a game that that really stands the test of time. And even today, it's not one of those games that was just interesting or relevant when it came out. And of course, the soundtrack, I almost forgot. The soundtrack was just absolutely amazing. So for all of these reasons, I think it's a game that even today is just a great game to play. And fortunately, it's not an exclusive anymore, so it's really easy to pick it up. Even if you don't want to get the original Dreamcast version, you can get it on the... I think it was released on the previous console generation, the Xbox 360 and PS3. It's also on PC, on Steam, and it plays great with a modern controller. You can actually use the second analog stick to move the camera around. Although I played the original one so much that even when playing on PC, I still use the trigger button to recenter the camera behind our character's back. I can't get rid of that habit. I can't let go. So it really is. I think it was an amazing game back then, and it still is. Almost 20 years later, it still is a unique game. There's nothing else quite like it except for the sequel, Jet Set Radio Future, and it's just an amazing game. So that's why I chose it for my first pick.
Great, great game. Yeah, I still play this, but I play this on my Vita because that's the only other console I have it on, I think. But yeah, I echo everything you've said. Brilliant game.
Yeah, I can't remember if there was crossplay between the Vita and PS3 versions. I'll have to go back through my library and see if that's the case. Maybe it isn't.
It's not. No, I found that out the hard way.
But at the very least, I'm always enthusiastic when games, iconic games like Jet Set Radio, kind of exist past the platform that they were originally contained to. And I know as Dreamcast and Saturn fans, it's nice to have those remnants of exclusives. But honestly, I think towards the broader goal of preserving these properties in the broader gaming, zeitgeist. It's nice to see whenever Sega or other indie developers take the mantle to bring these games to modern platforms for sure. So with that, Simon, what's your first pick?
Okay, my first pick is Shenmue, but not Shenmue 1, Shenmue 2, and it's specifically Shenmue 2 because Shenmue 2 was a game which was 10 times the price of most other Dreamcast games. When I was buying my first set of Dreamcast games, they were $2.50 from, I think it was the Blockbuster Video Store where I used to get them. But Shenmue 2 was £25, and I had no idea whatsoever what this game was. I'd never heard of it, didn't know anything about open world games. I'd never played a GTA game at this point. So I was completely blind. I bought it on the basis if it cost £25, it must be fabulous. I put it on. I'd never had no expectation. And the world that opened up to me when I put that game into my Dreamcast just absolutely blew me away. Mm. It was in Japanese with subtitles, which didn't put me off at all. In fact, it added to the sort of to the mystique and the feel of the game, and I just became lost in that game. It was referential to the Saturn because of obviously of the whole Virtua Fighter world in which it operated. It had games that you could play, arcade games such as Afterburner and Outrun and so on, and just the whole quest, the story, the characters, the music, every single thing about that game drew me in. And I was lost in that game and have been lost in that game for the last sort of 15 years. So that's for me. Shenmue was the game that cemented my love of the Dreamcast, my love of video games, really. It took on a whole new dimension after Shenmue. And it's sort of a game that I still come back to. It's a game that I will forever say is my favorite video game of all time. So that's my choice.
Is the second one your favorite, Simon, or is it the first?
No, for sure it's the second. And what happened was because I played them in the wrong order, when I actually got to play Shenmue and heard Ryo's American voice and sort of saw it as a smaller world, and a less colourful world, then it just didn't compare, really. It definitely, I think you need to play them in order so that you can experience how much of a fuller world the Shenmue 2 world is, the bigger world.
I think I often hear this kind of said that the first game is a better Shenmue game, but the second one's a better game overall. And I remember like playing the first one and stepping up to Shenmue 2, and the difference in the size and scope of what was going on was incredible to me. It is my favorite Shenmue as well. So yeah, I absolutely agree with everything you've said in regards to it.
It's just got a magic for me, that game. I mean, musically as well, I think it's got my favorite music from any game, and sort of it really did in many ways it opened the door to me to things like kung fu movies and stuff. It made me interested in the fighter culture, the Japanese fighter culture. So yeah, no, very, very, very dear game to me, and something that will always be my favorite, I think.
For sure. And you know, one of the things I've always appreciated about, well, both Shenmue, well, all the Shenmue games, particularly 1 and 2, speaking of attention to detail, I mean, I think that is one thing that I really appreciate about Shenmue, right? And it's predicated on having a world that is so fleshed out and dense. And one of the distinctions that I also notice between the first and the second one is the second one maybe in a way sacrifices that density for I guess breadth in a way. You know, I think they both have their charm and do an excellent job giving us a place that just feels like we can lose ourselves as virtual tourists, so to speak, in. And I really appreciate that about those games in particular. All right. Well, I guess that means it's my turn. So I was originally prepared to talk about Virtua Tennis 2, or Tennis 2K2 as it's known here in North America. But I had a change of heart moments before we went to record, because I stumbled upon, and I don't know how, a Samba de Amigo fanfic. It's kind of like a sleazy romantic fan fiction, and but it also like seemed fairly wholesome, which was an odd dichotomy. And so I like, I don't know, I just got thinking about it. I'm like, okay, I can't not talk about Samba de Amigo.
Sorry, Brian, I'm going to have to interrupt. Tell us how you actually stumbled upon this fan fiction, please.
Well, it is a hobby. I was trying to look up the character names. Nuno and I were trying to figure out if the monkey was named Amigo or Samba. Then we got into a whole discussion over the pronunciation, because Samba is a Portuguese word, and so maybe it's supposed to be pronounced in the Portuguese dialect or with the Spanish one. And then which Spanish is a whole nother line of questions beyond that. So, at any rate, it led down a rabbit hole. You know, I think the main reason here is that it's a game that I don't typically play. There aren't a lot of music games and rhythm games that I typically get into, other than the occasional like Beat Saber and that kind of thing. But Samba de Amigo really, in a way, has an infectious charm that mirrors the vibrancy and the charm of the Dreamcast itself. And I playing it today, you know, it's not a game you're going to be dumping a lot of hours into, but it's one of the few games that when I have a lot of friends over who don't typically play video games at all, I can put in Samba de Amigo. We got the whole maracas set up, so you have two of those and going, and everybody can't help but have a great time. Like it's such an infectiously joyous experience, just making complete idiots of ourselves while we're flailing around with these maracas. And I don't know, there's just some memories that I've built up from that in recent years that I think really mean a lot to me. And this is also kind of opening up a discussion of like what because, you know, the whole premise of this episode is one of our favorite Dreamcast games, or at least from our side, from the Saturn Junkyard Titancast crew. And so I've had a challenge delineating, like, well, what that means to me, right? Because Dreamcast A has so many incredible games, but B, you know, what's the distinction between quote unquote best, if there's an objective thing, which I don't think there is, versus what, or what's the thing we got the most joy out of, or what are the games that were most influential, or that are personally most meaningful for us, that we have that personal connection to. I mean, I think in a way I just kind of settled on, well, what are the games that I have that personal connection to, independent of other perceptions of quality that we might apply as in evaluating these games. So, yeah, Samba de Amigo, in that regard, I think means a lot, because my friends and I have had a wonderful time playing it over the years. And very much appreciate that.
Yeah, it's amazing game. I mean, I don't think it has the same kind of appeal to me on an emotional level, but certainly from a technical standpoint, I just think it's an amazing achievement for the Dreamcast, using those ingenious maracas and that kind of that sensor technology to such a creative way of allowing somebody to play a game. Certainly in the day before, in the era before true motion controls on TVs.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. So I guess that we can move on to our second Dreamcast picks here. Nuno, what do you got for us?
Well, and like my first choice, my second pick is a game that may not be as relevant today as it was back then. It's Metropolis Street Racer. And I think, in my opinion, it's one of the finest racing games for the Dreamcast. And it's not like the Dreamcast was lacking good racing games. But Metropolis Street Racer stood out for me. It was technically excellent. It really does still look really great. I played it not long ago on an emulator with resolution bumped up to full HD. And it still looked really, really good. Both the technical quality of the models and the textures, but also the actual tracks and the layouts of the tracks and how they put the scenery around the tracks. Back then, when it came out, I think it just looked absolutely amazing. And the gameplay is mostly arcade, although it's not as arcade as something like Daytona USA or Sega Rally. It goes for a kind of a mix between arcade and simulation. Kind of makes me think of Codemasters games like Colin McRae Rally and Race Driver. So kind of a mix, mostly arcade, but not completely arcade. A little bit of simulation too. There was a great progression element to it. You, for each race that you won, you would gain points called kudos. So you earn kudos, which you use to unlock new cars. You can actually bet against yourself on the races. For example, if you're running a time trial, you can reduce the target time. And if you can still pull it off, you'll earn more kudos, which is cool because you can kind of adapt the difficulty level to your ability at that point, to your level of skill or the level that you think you have. You, of course, then unlock new cars, and the progression was really good. It had a very complete career mode. Remember that back then, throughout the 90s, most racing games were very arcade-like affairs. You had like half a dozen of tracks to choose from, and you just play them over and over and over, like in an arcade mode or in time trials or something like that. There really wasn't much structure to them. By the end of the 90s and approaching 2000 or 2001, when I think this game came out, of course, you already saw other games come up with very thorough, very complete career modes to really keep you engaged. But it still wasn't really the norm, and this game had a very good career mode. That it was lengthy, but it was interesting. It was replaying the same track over and over because you would be unlocking new cars regularly, and the tracks were also very different from each other. And then if you were to mirror them, it would make for a very different experience and all of that. It spawned a kind of a sequel series, which is Project Gotham Racing 1 and 2 on the Xbox, the original Xbox, and then 3 and 4 on the Xbox 360. I played through all of them. 2 and 3 are particular favorites of mine. I think they were absolutely amazing games. Unfortunately, the producer, Bizarre Creations, they closed down, so there's no chance for a new game. I would love to have a Project Gotham 5 or Metropolis Street Racer 2. Unfortunately, that's not going to happen. I think it's one of the best racing games on Dreamcast, and even today, I may be blinded by nostalgia, but I think that even today, it can still be a lot of fun and a really immersive experience.
Nuno, I have to say that this is also one of my favorite games on the Dreamcast, and I even played it today. I've played this game more than it's healthy. I've written thousands upon thousands of words about how great this game is. Everything you just said resonated with me amazingly well, and it's just a superb game. Even just as a piece of art, the way the amount of detail in this game, the amount of effort the developers put into this game, the thousands upon thousands of photographs they took of real world cities, the real time lighting, even down to the details of like the birds in the sky and the flight paths of planes overhead. There's so much detail in this game. It's incredible for its time. And yeah, I would agree with everything you just said, 100%.
Yeah, it's an incredible game. As a big racing game fan as well, I played hours and hours of this. It's a superb game. It's got everything from a bit of drifting to actually really tight racing, and it's very well balanced as well. There are some issues with having to kind of get kudos to unlock things like different multiplayer method modes and things like that. But ultimately, I think it's just a superb game, so a great shout. The other thing, it's a really small detail, but just as Tom was saying, on the scope of the game and where they decided to go with detail and things like that, it was the first game I ever remember playing, and I don't recall actually if any other game had done this before, to actually have the radio stations changeable in the car. And not only that, but when you went into a tunnel, it would kind of you'd get the interference and the white noise as you went through a tunnel, and little touches like that just made it so authentically realistic, good, fun. It was just so good. Just superb game.
Yeah, I totally forgot about the radio stations. Thanks for bringing that up.
So these are our second picks for our favorite Dreamcast games, and I think that brings us to Simon. What's yours?
Okay, my second pick is not so much a game as an experience, because I'm going to pick Caution Seaman for my second choice, which is, I guess, what you might call a pet simulator. You have to bring a amphibious seaman creature to life from a tadpole sort of fish egg type thing, and you raise him in a tank, you feed him, you set the conditions right in terms of temperature and oxygen, and you speak to him through a microphone, and as he grows from a tiny tadpole type creature into a frog fish man, he speaks to you and asks you various things about your life. He remembers those things. He remembers your birthday. He remembers various things like what job you do and whether you are married and so on. And you have conversations with this creature through a microphone peripheral, which comes with the game. This was the first time I'd ever seen or heard of anything voice activated. And the technology, I think, for the year 2000 is just absolutely superb. If you suspend your disbelief ever so slightly, and you have to be willing, a willing participant in this experience, you can really, really feel like you are speaking to a creature, a sentient creature, a friendly, funny, crabby, grumpy creature that will throw his crap at you from time to time. It's hard for me to explain this. For anyone listening who has no experience of this game or no idea of this game, then it's going to sound very strange, but it's one of the most rewarding video game experiences I've ever had. It certainly showed the quirky side of the Dreamcast and of Sega's willingness to put quirky IPs out there And it's just something that I think if you have a Dreamcast and you haven't done Seaman, then you haven't experienced the console properly. So I just say that would be my second choice.
Wait, so throwing crap, are we talking literally, figuratively, a little bit of both?
He literally uses his poop tube, which is on the top of his head, to fling crap at you, particularly if you use the word shit. if you use the word shit, or if you say shit to him, he will fling his crap at you. Yeah.
Wow.
I don't think there's a more, for anyone who says, oh yeah, the Japanese aren't that culturally different, just point them at this game. This game couldn't be more Japanese. It is the weirdest game, and yet I introduced my Japanese friend to this when I moved over there, and he was blown away by it, and he went and bought Dreamcast so that he could play this. He thought it was amazing, best thing ever, and it is a brilliant game, but oh my god, is it weird.
Yeah, and I think even in you know, his Seaman's attitude, he also kind of gives you a fair amount of shit that way as well, in that regard.
He gets friendlier the longer the game continues, and the more the closer it gets to the finale, and I won't say what that is, but he does tend to become nicer and less crabby. He's very grumpy in his early stages, and he often just doesn't even want to speak to you at all.
Okay.
The Seaman finale.
We won't go there. I feel like it's a game I think I need to get further, you know, try... revisit and maybe be more persistent at. What always happens is I'll play it for a couple of days, and then I'll just stop playing it for a while, and then Seaman is dead when I come back and have failed to upkeep the tank and everything. So I'll have to try to do that again. All right, so I do also have a second pick, and this one is going to be. Here's the thing. I love racing games. And I think, Martin, as you alluded to earlier with Wipeout 97, I mean, there's an element of the genre that becomes very satisfying when you can immerse yourself in like a sort of flow state while you're, you know, spending hours kind of learning the ins and outs of each track and mastering the various curves and nuances and also the feeling and weight of your vehicle and how all of that responds and the best way to approach everything. And I also appreciate something that strikes a balance between that like arcade and sim style, but maybe errs on the side of arcade most of the time, as well as has a chill vibe. And there are so many games on the Dreamcast that scratch this itch. Metropolis Street Racer, as we just mentioned, is another one. Tokyo Extreme Racer 1 and 2, Rush 2049, Suzuki All-Stare, Trick Style. I mean, I can go on. Like, I love all of these games for that confluence of reasons. But I think the one that really stands out to me has to be Test Drive Le Mans. Or Le Mans 24 Hours, as it's known in PAL territories. And it took me a while to put my finger on why this game resonated with me so much. And I think it was a pretty standard game, all things considered, although it does have a literal 24-hour mode where you can play through, or where you drive or race the Le Mans course over the course of 24 hours. And I think you can save at certain points so you don't have to do it all in setting or sitting, though you probably could try. But I've always enjoyed it, and I never really got into it as much until and I will credit the Dreamcast Junkyard Facebook community. I think Kev Mason had a challenge at one point. This was a couple of years ago, and that was one of my first experiences with really any of the Junkyard communities, but also my first time like really forcing myself to learn the all of the nuances of that game. And so I was able to hunker down, and I was really blown away at that point, just through the repetition of learning the Le Mans course, of what that tangible sense of reward is, and kind of getting into its flow and rhythm and becoming more confident in my approach to every part of the course, and plus the other courses, which are all based on real world tracks or racetracks. But I really enjoy that the level of depth in the real-time sense. There aren't really a lot of customization options. You're not, you know, tuning gear ratios or anything, but there's, you know, drafting, there's variable weather, which affects the handling a little bit. There's degrading tire conditions. You have to manage, you know, you have to pay attention to your fuel supply, and all of these things kind of work together throughout each race to dynamically impact how you approach the your moment-to-moment strategies from lap to lap. And I think there's something there that was really addicting to me. And once I understood what those little pieces were, they kind of, I don't know, it just felt like there was maybe a hypnotic Zen-like trance that I kind of fell into. And for that, I just love Le Mans. And I continue to keep playing or revisiting it today because it might just be my favorite Dreamcast racing game and one of my favorite racing games of all time, easily.
Yeah, just on that topic, again, this is a superlative racing game for the Dreamcast, quite different from the other versions on other consoles. I believe it was, you know, built from the ground up for the Dreamcast to take advantage of the extra power on offer. I do believe that, Mike, you have spent the entire 24 hours doing the Le Mans course. Is that correct?
Yes, Tom, I am that insane.
I remember you telling me that you sat there for the entire 24 hours doing that.
I think Nino mentioned earlier on about the fact that MSR felt like a Codemasters racing game. To me, Le Mans is the perfect precursor to the Race Driver series came afterwards. It just controls really smoothly. It's a fantastic game. I mean, it's really, really good. 24 hours in a row isn't so good.
Did you do all that yourself, Mike?
Yes, Mike.
Because, like, in real life, the drivers change over.
I didn't.
That's pretty hardcore.
I did took a bit, like a few hours between after when he could save, but I did try and do it. I think we were talking, me and Kev were talking about it as some kind of like stream, and then obviously we didn't, so I just decided to do it myself because that's what I do.
Don't you have to go into the pits to save?
Yeah,
I thought so. Still quite an achievement, but great pick, Brian. I agree.
Yeah, I also feel a little foolish. It's Le Mans, or because I've been saying Le Mans, and I don't think that's right now.
I think Le Mans. Yeah, Le Mans
with an N.
Or Le Mans.
Yeah,
Le Mans.
It depends how French you want to go with it.
It's not my forte, which that's an Italian word, I think. But yeah. All right. Well, thank you. Thank you all for your additional insights on that. Let's go on to our third picks, I think, at this point. Nuno, what's yours?
Well, my third pick is Headhunter, which is a game that came very late into the Dreamcast life cycle. And probably because of that, not many people may have played it. And it's almost like a best of all of the 90s, late 90s 3D action games. It is a third-person action game, but it's not just going around shooting at bad guys. There's stealth elements that kind of bring to mind Metal Gear Solid. There's a lot of Resident Evil in the way that you have to solve environmental puzzles in the levels and pick up items and go back and forth throughout levels to unlock new areas and use item B in slot C and, you know, the usual Resident Evil vibe. But also in between missions, you got to ride a motorcycle throughout town to get to the next area. And these bike sections were fully 3D. So it gives you this really cool idea of a vast city that you get to explore. And I think it's not an exaggeration to say that it's the closest the Dreamcast got to a GTA game, a Grand Theft Auto game, where you have like this huge 3D, fully 3D city that you could drive around in. Unfortunately, you couldn't get on foot in these sections. You always stayed on your bike. But it was just a really great way to change up the pace and to give just this new experience. I could criticize the story, which is a bit cheesy and predictable. And the main character isn't really charismatic or interesting, just like your typical dumb action guy, from what I remember at least. But gameplay wise, I think it was a really interesting game. So overall, I think the best praise that I can give to this game is that it really does a little bit of everything. It brings a lot of different concepts together, but I think they work well. They complement each other. I think it, if you like 3D action games, on the slower side, it's not like shooting fast. As I just said, there's a lot of Resident Evil in it, in the way that you have to explore the levels that go back and forth as you gather new items to unlock new sections. But yeah, it's a game that stuck with me for some reason. And I still have really good memories of it. And I didn't even play it back when it came out. I only played it a handful of years later. But for some reason, it really stuck with me. I think there's something really interesting and unique to it.
Yeah, I agree again with pretty much everything you've said. I think it's really interesting, especially because it's such a late release and it's only a PAL exclusive. And something about the atmosphere in the world kind of reminds me of like a Paul Verhoeven film, this kind of near future, like a, almost like a RoboCop style world aesthetic that it's got. And these kind of news reports that kind of chop in every now and then about, you know, these pharmaceutical companies that are like ruling the world. I think the one thing that I didn't particularly like about the game was the controls of the motorcycle, just trying to navigate around the city streets. It's very easy to pop a wheelie, which means you can't steer and you just end up smashing into a house or into a wall. But other than that, yeah, it's a great looking game. It's got a really good storyline. And yeah, it's just a really, really nice 3D adventure game. Quite a late one and a PAL only release, so a lot of people haven't played it on the Dreamcast.
It's in my backlog for sure. I think after this, I'll probably move it up a few notches and try to play through Headhunter soon. Because yeah, it does sound like a really interesting game for its time, particularly considering the state of the industry as games are kind of opening up with under the influence of Grand Theft Auto 3, so to speak, as well as Metal Gear Solid and that popularization of those types of narrative experiences.
One thing I will say about this game as well, the last thing, is the soundtrack is absolutely exquisite. It's done by Richard Jacks, the same guy who did the music for Metropolis Street Racer.
Yeah.
So it's quite appropriate that Nuno chose two games that were scored by Richard Jacks. So, yeah.
Well, cool. Thank you very much, Nuno. And that leads us to Simon, your third pick. What have you got for us?
Okay, well, my third pick was the game that really sold the Dreamcast to my friends and family. It was hard to sell a console that was sort of... I got my first Dreamcast in 2004, and people wanted to know why I was at all interested in this console and if I kind of got it out on a Friday, Saturday night when guys were around for a few beers, they would sort of look disdainfully at it until I put on Soul Calibur, which would be a game which would just grab their attention, A, because it is such a fabulous looking game. The characters all look amazing and the world is presented in a really sort of flashy, colourful way. But then the actual gameplay, it's a sort of a weapons-based fighting game made by Namco, who I have to say I think make the best fighting games, 3D fighting games anyway. And it was a game that you didn't have to have a lot of skill to play. You had to be able to mash buttons effectively, which is one of my very few gaming skills. I am actually really, really good at mashing buttons in a random and sort of out of control way, but that would enable you to win and could take you pretty far in Soul Calibur. There was skill to be had and there was moves to be learned and combos to be learned and so on, but I never learned them. I did massively enjoy playing against people, and one of the greatest things to do when you have actually beaten someone in Soul Calibur, you can keep hitting them for about 3 or 4 seconds after they've been defeated. So you can just keep hitting and hitting and hitting, which seemed to really frustrate and upset the person you beat. And also, you could rinse and repeat moves as well, which was something which would infuriate people if you just kept beating them in the same way without giving them a second or a chance to recover. So there was that. But there was also the fact that it had an incredible single player campaign, which allowed you to unlock new characters, new modes, game modes, and art cards, which sort of told the story of all of the various fighters. And they're all a strange bunch picked throughout history, various sort of archetypes of pirates and knights from medieval times. There's monsters, reptilians, and all kinds of things. And they've all got a really good weapon. Like each character has a long reach weapon or something like nunchakus, which they can use really fast. But they would like the weapons would be really effective and really, really deadly. And it was just an overall, for me, it's the best fighting game of all time, Soul Calibur. And that would be my third choice.
That's a nice pick. For me, Soul Calibur, it was the first fighting game I got on the Dreamcast, played a lot with my brother, and exactly as you say about the mechanics, when you beat someone, you've got that extra few seconds where they're basically just like a limp vegetable, and you can just launch and destroy them. Is extremely frustrating when you're, you know, a teenager. That's absolutely infuriating. And also, with the game, it doesn't matter almost how much you practice. And, you know, with Street Fighter, you can practice your moves and get them down, and there are these super fighters and combos. With Soul Calibur, you could give the pad almost to, you know, the four-year-old and have them just play at buttons, and they would still beat you with Kilik and this large rod and just kick your ass. And so, yeah, it's a brilliant game, but also it levels the playing field completely. You can't like be a master at Soul Calibur, I don't think.
Which was why I particularly liked it, because I was never a master at anything. So
yeah, me too. I'm terrible at Street Fighter. I can light Hadouken and that's it. And so with Soul Calibur, you can string together combos like a genius, but you have no idea what you've just done. So it's great.
Yeah, I'd echo again everything that Simon's just said about Soul Calibur. It's an achievement, really. To look better than the arcade version and be an amazing title in its own right. And let's not forget the amazing single player mode, you know, that has you going all around that map. It's just, there's so much gameplay there. There's so much to do. It's just, it's the full package, isn't it?
Yeah. Honestly, I think it's held up better than most games I could have ever imagined. I just was playing it earlier this week, and I think there's an art to the simplicity of its combo system, and everything feels a lot more intuitive. You don't have a lot of quarter or half circles or any of that stuff to worry about that you have to work on memorizing. It's more just like, oh, I want to do a vertical slash and then follow it up with do an air juggle or something. It's so easy to do those things. And then once you learn how to string that within each character's momentum and animation structure, it just becomes, I don't know, there's something intuitive to it that you just don't have to think about. And it was funny not playing it for years, revisiting again this week and being able to do everything that I remember. And it was, it's held up incredibly well, I think.
Also, Voldo is the hero we all need right now.
A man who wears suspenders to fight is a man who's all right in my book.
Truer words have never been said. All right, so I think that leads us into one of mine. And it is a game that I also think has held up incredibly well. And let me preface this a little bit, and sorry if I get a little long-winded here, but recently my girlfriend and I were playing through Valkyria Chronicles, which is like a military action strategy game set in kind of like a pastel-colored World War II alternate Europe, or like sort of not really Europe, but it's basically Europe. And you command a small regiment of troops against like the big imperial big bad enemy, right? Which is the Nazi Germany stand-in. And among the troops that you have is or have at your disposal is are Ica and Vice from Skies of Arcadia. And we were playing this game and we were building up, my girlfriend was going through all the characters, she was setting up her squad for a mission, and I chime in like an idiot. And I'm just like, hey, you got to have Ika and Vice on your team. I mean, come on. Like, why would you not do that? And she's like looking through the strengths and weaknesses of all the characters. And she's like, yeah, but Ika, like, this mission is on a grass field. Ika has a pollen allergy. I'm sorry. I am not bringing Ika into these conditions. And I'm just kind of dumbfounded. I'm like, I just can't comprehend why you wouldn't include these characters at all times on your team. And I think that's when it struck me how deep and irrational and just how strong a connection I had to the world and especially the characters of Skies of Arcadia on the Dreamcast. I guess it's been like 15 years since I had played it. And I think I underestimated how much of an enduring impact that game has had on me. And of course, I don't know how much of an introduction actually needs among your audience. I think everybody who's a Dreamcast fan is probably, at least to some extent, familiar with Skies of Arcadia, that it's a JRPG and that it's kind of a globe-trotting RPG where you pirate an airship around pilot an airship around and you play as air pirates, namely Vice and Ika, and you explore all these distinct continents with their own like cultures and aesthetic differences and narrative unique narrative situations and charming characters to meet and a lot of them I think are so memorable, right? And you also stumble across a mysterious girl named Fina, and again you're battling a big evil imperial antagonist. I forget what they're called. You're basically going through this game, and I think it has just a sense of exploration and adventure that's unparalleled with most JRPGs that I played at the time. Even if it's not structurally too different from a lot of them. In fact, I almost think there's a lot of parallels with Panzer Dragoon Saga in a way, and just how it balances that on foot exploration with doing so via your ship. And I don't know. It's hard to really pin down why this game still means so much to me outside of it's just infectiously vibrant and optimistic. And one of the other things I really like is the sheer expressiveness and charm of all the characters too. And I think that really is what stuck with me. And also the dialogue is, I'm surprised to find out how well it has been translated. And I think it's just really well written, which I think for a JRPG of that era might be kind of rare. And I hate to say that, but at any rate, yeah, I love this game and I look forward to embarking on that voyage again. All right. Well, let's go into our final pick. And I think, Nuno, it is probably your turn.
So for my last pick, I chose D2, which, as the name implies, is the sequel to D, which is actually a Saturn game. So it really ties in together with the theme of this podcast. Although I haven't actually played the original D yet. It's on my pile of shame. One day I'll get around to it. But I don't think the stories are actually related in any way. I don't know. I may be wrong about this. But I think mostly D2 is a standalone game. But yeah, it's a horror game. And it's mostly played in third person. But the action sequences, you fight with guns. And the combat sequences are actually in first person. So that already mixes up the gameplay, which is something that I really like. And it's set in Canada, but like really up north in the icy wilderness. So it's set in the snow, which is a rather interesting and original setting. There's a lot of just empty snow, wide spaces, which can be really eerie in their right. And I think it had really interesting gameplay. I can't remember much of the story. From what I remember, it was really freaking weird. But mostly I think it had a really great atmosphere. And for a horror game, I think that's really essential when I think about it. So, yeah, I think that just in general, it's probably one of the more original horror games I played. Probably not the most original. I mean, even on Dreamcast, you have stuff like You'll Bleed that's really out there. But compared to standard Resident Evil clones that abounded at the time, I think it does do some things here in a very unique way. And most of all, I think it's a really enjoyable game.
Yeah, I think it's a great game. You know, I mean, I've only sampled kind of the first half of the game, I think. But it's interesting that the game started life as an M2 project and then kind of morphed onto the Dreamcast and has still got this kind of mythical kind of aura around it, even though it actually came out on the Dreamcast. But yeah, it's one that I don't think a lot of people have played, certainly in PAL territories, because obviously it wasn't released here, which I, again, find quite odd, especially because it was quite an early game and one that really showed off what the Dreamcast could do, like, visually. But yeah, again, a great choice and a really cool adventure.
I absolutely love this game as well. I've played all of it because I used to leave my Dreamcast at home and go away to uni, and then I was always like, I need to go back and finish D2, and I did. And it's definitely a really just weird, unique game, and probably has quite a lot of flaws, but I think the scope and ambition of what Kenji Ino was going for can make you forgive a lot of the game's downfalls. The atmosphere is incredible. So, yeah, it's quite misunderstood. And like Tom said, a lot of people in Europe probably didn't even get a chance to play it. But, yeah, it's definitely worth picking it up if you can.
All right. Well, I think, Simon, that brings us to you. What is your fourth and final pick for this episode?
My last pick is Sonic Adventure, which was Sonic's first attempt into the 3D world on a commercial basis. Bit of a buggy game which divides people in terms of whether they think it's a good 3D platformer or not. I think it's a perfectly acceptable game, but the reason I've chosen it is not because of the game itself, it's because of the ability to go to the Chao Garden and put a Chao onto your VMU, which is, as everyone knows, the Dreamcast's memory unit. And you could take that Chao off with your VMU. You could take it out of your Dreamcast controller, and as long as you had a little CR32 battery in it, you could take your Chao away and train him. And you could build up his strength and his vitality and his fighting ability. And you could play that as a little mini game, which I unfortunately did play many, 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 many hours with this little tiny Chao, training it up, giving it fruit, playing the mini games that come with it. But it's for me, it was a perfect example of the Dreamcast's it's one of those things that Dreamcast has that other consoles never did. It's that originality of the peripherals, the ability to use that VMU to play a game on. I just think was so fabulous, so amazing, so clever. And it's for that very reason that I've picked Sonic Adventure, just because I had so much fun with my Chao and my VMU. And so that's my last pick.
Nice.
I think that's another great shout there, Simon. And Sonic Adventure, yeah, it's extremely popular, famous. It's got its issues with camera angles and things like that, but overall, I remember being extremely excited to play this after such a long wait for a Sonic game. Following on from this Christmas night's demo of Sonic in this kind of pseudo 3D, we had Sonic R and all these kind of attempts at Sonic. Here we are with proper Sonic, in a sense. And yeah, it's a brilliant game. And I too also spent way too much money on CR2032 batteries for VMUs to keep my Chao going. Yeah, great memories.
Yeah, I have to agree. And I think I owe a lot to Sonic Adventure, just simply because it was the game that got me interested in the Dreamcast and really video gaming as a whole. And I actually wrote a article a while back on the Dreamcast Junkyard to this effect. But at the end of the day, I mean, it's a game that's forced me to reconcile what I think is a good game versus what is a game that's personally meaningful to me, as I had mentioned earlier. And that's certainly one that I think means a lot to me today, even if it's really difficult for me to go back and enjoy it the same way I did when I first got my Dreamcast and it was the only game I had for 3 months and just played the heck out of it and loved it that whole time. Okay, I guess it's me now. Here is my final pick. And for this one, I feel like this is a game that could really only exist on the Dreamcast, and that is Blue Stinger, which is developed by Climax Graphics, and it's conceived of, and I think he was the producer, Shinya Nishigaki, and rest in peace. He passed away several years ago, but it's a very interesting game that has a very niche appeal, I feel, and it seems to have a little bit of a cult classic status among the Dreamcast fan community. I'm not sure if others have that sense, but it's also certainly a game that's fairly divisive, and there are at least an equal number, if not far more, people who may just dismiss it and may feel like, oh, it's a pretty flawed and quirky experience. It's not really that good. So I wouldn't blame anybody for dismissing it in the same way that I wouldn't really blame anybody for dismissing the Dreamcast, which is also a very charming, albeit, ultimately a flawed platform in itself. And I think, we're still here because it was charming. And to that end, I still play Blue Stinger because I found it incredibly charming. And I also appreciated its like commitment to vibrancy, I suppose, because a lot of people will lump it into, I guess, the Resident Evil or Silent Hill style of survival horror games, and it just, I don't know, I think that's an unfair comparison because it was never meant to be anything like that. In fact, I would more equate it to like a beat 'em up that has a little more breadth in a way. So it's like a beat 'em up with a heavy emphasis of exploration, and it's all kind of wrapped into like a campy B-movie style of cinematic influence or presentation. And through that lens, I really do believe that Blue Stinger is a very novel and profoundly charming game. I also played it through recently, and I was very surprised that to find that it's held up far better than I think it had any right to. And I really loved that gameplay loop it had, where you're kind of massacring monsters and then you're buying, new weapons and vending machines with a bunch of coins that drop from the monsters. So you can kind of, there's a grinding element if you, and you can, from those vending machines, you can buy weapons and food and ammo. And some of the weapons you use, I think, are just really, really enjoyable to me. I mean, they have the baton rods and the electric baton rods and a lightsaber, basically, as yeah. well as more heavy pack, heavy hitting things like napalm launchers and rocket launchers, and even t-shirts that bestow your character with like a kung fu abilities and sumo moves, which I always thought was really quirky and charming in itself. But yeah, there was just something to that structure, and I really enjoyed the locale of the game. It's based on this one island that has a kind of an urban town setting, but also a series of labs and areas where in facilities that you can really see how things went down, because it's it all happened on like Christmas Eve, I guess, is the premise, and so the whole town is brightly lit with very festive decor, but in an instant, all these monsters, all these people, like turned into monsters from I can't remember all the details, but of course it's like that those lab experiments go awry kind of premise, and then they murder everybody else who didn't turn into a monster. And so you arrive on the island shortly after that, and everything is still, it hasn't really had a chance to decay yet. It's still all very vibrant and very Christmassy, including all the music, especially in the town that is still stuck in my brain to this day. But yeah, it's another one of those games that by a lot of metrics that we traditionally have been brought up to evaluate games, it fails on, right? The camera is kind of wonky. I mean, the controls take a little getting used to. I think a lot of people might find it a boring game, but I love it, and I am just very happy to have a game like this that kind of exemplifies that charm despite its flaws, in a way that I think a game like this, or like, I don't know, like I said, I really think this game deserves a Dreamcast, and likewise, because to me those two things, the Blue Stinger is inseparable from that vibrancy and charm of the Dreamcast.
Yeah, that's a really nice way of describing it, to be honest. And I, again, I'd like to say that I do agree with everything you've just said. And one of the memories that sticks with me of Blue Stinger is that it's a game that in the early days of the Dreamcast, I only had like one game at a time. And I remember specifically renting this game from Blockbuster over a weekend and realizing that I only had it for the weekend. I did everything I could to complete the game, and I did actually finish the game in a weekend. Going back to the game in more recent times, I found that I couldn't do it. I found it too difficult, and it was just something weird about the fact that I did this. I finished this game back then as a kid, and now I'm having trouble with like something that's really early on in the game. And I can vividly remember the final battle going up that tower, and I'm thinking to myself, how did I manage that then with no guides, I don't know, but yeah, it's one of them games that really like sticks in the mind. I read an article recently, or rather quite a while back actually, and this is probably something I've mentioned on the podcast in the past. It's an article on Gamer Sutra, which is about the guy who created the game. Sorry, how do you pronounce it? Shinya Ishigaki?
Nishigaki, I think.
Yeah. Basically, this guy, John Anderson, wrote a really nice article about how he was interviewing him. Then mid-interview, after writing most of his thoughts down, he went back to continue the interview, and the gentleman had died. And it was really kind of melancholy and a bit, it really stayed with me. And that interview can be found quite easily. Type Ill Bleed Blue Stinger, and it's the first hit that comes up, but it's on Gamer Sutra. Well worth a read. It's quite a sad interview, but it's worth a read.
Okay. Well, I think that is the run of the list of all of the picks we had for our favorite Dreamcast games. I think, Tom, I can turn it back over to you if you'd like to close this thing out.
Yeah. I mean, that's been a really fascinating chat. It's been really cool hearing games that we kind of discuss all the time on our own podcast, but to have a different kind of viewpoint, really, from you guys, it's been quite fascinating. And it's also like a little kind of look into like your lives and also the experiences that you had with these games. It's been a real experience, shall we say. I think we'll draw it to a close there. We've been chatting now for just over 2 hours. So good luck with the edit, Lewis.
woo.
Thank you very much for listening. I hope you've listened all the way to the end. It's been fun for me. It's been fun, I hope, for everybody else who's been on the podcast. We won't go around and do individual kind of Twitter handles or anything like that, but what I will say is if you want to find us on Twitter, you can find us at the DC Junkyard.
We are at thesaturnjunkyard.blogspot.com. And we also have our podcast, The Titan Cast, which is pretty much everywhere you get podcasts.
Excellent stuff. Well, thank you for listening. That's you, the listener. And also thank you to my massive cadre of co-hosts, Brian, Nuno, Martin, Simon, Mike, Lewis, and of course, me, Tom. Thanks very much for listening. This has been episode 76 of the Dreamcast Junkyard Dream Pod Cross Titan Cast. And we will see you on the next episode. Thanks very much for listening and goodbye.
Please stop this disc now.
Why don't you challenge again?